Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Melanie, I did want to mention for the listener to check out the next episode of Catholics of Oz coming up this weekend, because I'm in it. I did not travel to Australia.
Sadly,
I wish I could. As I said to friends, Lindsay and Caroline and Lino, who are host the Catholics of Oz, that Americans love Australia. I mean, that's sort of a broad generalization, of course, but I think Americans and Australians, we kind of get along. And I didn't say it at the time in the podcast, but I was thinking about this. Australians are kind of like rowdy Canadians.
I suppose.
You know, Canadians have this reputation for being nice and polite and sorry.
Yes.
Yeah. Australians are nice. Like, I are generally nice people. I'm sure there are jerks everywhere, of course. But most Australians I've met have been nice people. But they also are kind of like party fun sorts of people too.
And our Canadian friends are saying, I'm a fun party kind of person.
I'm fun. If you have to tell us. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just thinking in general, like personality stereotypes of a country. Germans are very, you know, rigid and bound by, you know, rules. No, of course, that's not all Germans. I mean, they're laid back Germans, I'm sure, somewhere. You know, Italians love to eat and
very emotional.
Very emotional and yell a lot. That actually is kind of on target.
Pretty much.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, there's these national personalities, and I think that's the national personality of Australia. Anyway, I had a lot of fun, and I hope that you listen to it and enjoy it too, because it was a blast. And as I told them, one day we will do this in person in Australia. That's my goal.
Some days are like that.
It's my bucket list.
Even in Australia. Even... And when do they have that book in Australia?
I should have asked. But see, that the book right there presupposes, like, Alexander and the horrible, terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. And he says, some days are bad days.
Even in Australia.
Even in Australia, which presupposes that the idea of a bad day in Australia, that just seems, that's hard to believe. But, you know, just saying. Okay, we're way off target. So let's get going on our topics today.
Whoa, yeah.
I just wanted to get a little tangent of what I, you know, to recommend the podcast. But, you know, all right. So. This has been a busy week at Lake Wobegone, which actually, given the coronavirus restrictions, we are pretty Wobegone in general, but we've had a busy week.
We have.
More of a busy weekend.
We finally have had good weather, which the break in the rain, the unrelenting rain and cold has done amazing. It's I feel like a new person.
Yes.
And
finally.
Yeah.
Spring is here.
And then combined with the fact that you had your first Saturday with no work obligations
right.
in, I don't even know how long.
More than a month.
It's yeah. been a long time.
Yeah. Where I didn't have a board meeting for the pro-life organization or a scout thing or recording podcasts or anything like that. We had just a weekend clear.
So of course, we did work, but we worked in the garden.
Yes.
Outside all day long.
So
it was awesome.
Yeah. Let's talk about what we did. So, and this is just the last 2 days, you know, Saturday and Sunday, because Friday it was rainy and cold still. And in all of April was half of April was rain. So it rained 15 out of 30 days, just to kind of set why this is such a big deal. And we've had one day in the past 7 months that was 74 degrees.
That was in January.
And that was in January. And so on Saturday, it got up to 66 or 67. And today, as we record this, it was 75. Actually, just north of us in Boston, it was 81.
Wow.
I mean, yeah. So beautiful and sunny both days. So what did we do? You mentioned the garden bed. I've been planning for a while.
A long while.
A long while. to rebuild our garden bed. So years ago, we built these, these 4x4 square, three of them square garden beds in the backyard, made out of 4x4. So they were like, there was very low to the ground. It was just really an area with dirt, where there was dirt instead of lawn and then dirt in it. It wasn't really that separated. And it worked for a couple years, right?
Yeah. We had a couple years of good gardens.
Yeah. We talked about this last week, so I don't want to rehash too much of it. So finally, and I was just missing one piece of the puzzle to put it all together, which was the rebar. So I went to Lowe's early Saturday morning, which was surprisingly crowded, but everybody had their masks, which was good. And I got the six half inch, 2 foot long rebar that I needed for $15. It was surprisingly easy given the hassle it was to get them, and brought it home and then started laying it out with the kids. I had the kids helping me, Ben and Anthony and Sophie, carrying the wood, laying out the blocks. It's this slide in these corner blocks that are concrete, and you slide the boards into it sideways. And so is it two feet tall? No, it was like 1 foot tall when the two boards are, I think they're 2x6s. So the bed is 2 feet tall. Wait a second. Let me think.
I have no idea.
It's 2 feet. It is 2 feet because they're two blocks. Yeah. So whatever. it's fairly tall. It's going to be a lot of dirt. And so it's 4x8 foot sections connected to each other. And so we had to measure and cut. And I had the boys were measuring and making the marks. I was cutting. I'm not giving them a circular saw.
not yet.
Yeah, not yet. And then, but they were doing the carrying and the placing. I did the pounding of the rebar into the ground because they gave it the old college try, but it wasn't working. They could barely lift
the
hammer.
They don't have the
upper body strength yet. But it was great. And then when it was done, we had to dig up the sod that was inside the box, and I wanted to move that to where the old garden bed was to kind of re-sod it if we can get that sod to take place. And they were in there for most of the afternoon. And here's the thing. They love working hard, especially the boys. But Sophie was into it too. They love physical labor. And on days when they've worked hard, at the end of the day, they are happy. They sleep better. They have a better demeanor. I mean, it's amazing how like their personality perks up when they've been working.
You know, it's kind of funny because in our readings this week, the kids and I were talking about the St. Joseph the Worker and like the value of work. And so then like we had a nice object lesson on that on Saturday.
Yeah.
Jesus and Joseph both did manual labor, and you know that sanctifies manual labor.
Right.
It's good for us to work with our hands.
Right. Exactly. There is something in us that values work, and especially, I mean, the male female divide. There's different kinds of work, but that manual labor when you're a guy, there's something about getting out there and getting your hands dirty, getting your hands on a thing and building a thing, making it. I mean, it's not a complicated thing, but it's still building a thing and making it. And there's something there that wasn't there when they're done. And and I think like that's part of the problem with these long winters we have is they're stuck indoors. And I mean, they're building things with Lego, which is sort of creative in that sense,
right,
but there's not physical labor and they don't get a chance to do that physical hard work.
Right. We try, but
there's only
just,
so much we can do. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, and sometimes I think they would thrive if we lived in an environment that had shorter winters, or if we had the sort of life where outdoor physical labor in the winter was something that we did. I mean, if it snowed, they could shovel. In fact, Ben loves to shovel the snow.
Right.
We didn't get much snow this year. Yeah, like if you're going to have a long winter, you at least should have some snow. We didn't even have that. It was a terrible winter. Anyway, so the other thing we did was Scouts, Boy Scouts of America. This weekend was the Great American Camp-In. They had programmed it. And there was a, they had this whole, you were supposed to set up a campsite at your house, indoors or outside. Some people don't have a backyard they can set a tent up in. And they were, they had a full slate of live streamed video things that they were programmed throughout the day, which we didn't watch because we wanted to be outside.
Right. It was much too nice to be watching live stream.
Yes. So, but we kind of participated. We got out our tent and we set up our big tent. We set up our hammocks. We set up our camp kitchen. We set up a, the fire pit and all the camp chairs. So we have a righteous campsite in our backyard. I'm not sure what I was going for there, but we have a right jolly campsite. And then it was really a lot of fun setting it up with them, and they were really into it. We had all our camp gear out, and Bella was so into it, because Bella is, of course, as we've said before, she's a scout. She's a BSA scout.
She wanted to set up the camp kitchen, and then once we got everything, the tent and everything set up, she pulled out her scout manual and her rope, and she started practicing her knot tying.
All the knots that she's been taught by the scoutmaster and assistant scoutmaster, Chris and Adam, have been teaching the girls their knots, and Bella was practicing them all. And she was doing really well with it. She did like a lashing for a tripod. That came out really well.
Yeah, that was impressive.
But it was impressive how she, Lucy saw her and was watching her, and she kind of started teaching Lucy how to do the knots.
Yeah, Lucy did a nice, which one did she do?
A square knot. Yeah. And Bella is a really good teacher, I think. I think she has a real natural teaching way about her.
She does.
And she's patient. That's the important teacher.
Very important.
But yeah, so it was really nice to see. And so it was just such a really great day. And then today we didn't do much at all in that realm. Although we did do some cooking outdoors. I'll get to that in a few minutes. But we kind of hung out today, really. They were the boys and Sophie were kind of sore from all the shoveling.
Right.
My legs are sore.
I didn't figure they would be up for doing much more today after the hard work they did on Saturday.
Yeah. But they did do some running around. There was some indoor iPad and screen time and things like that. I think they were sort of compensating for having none of that yesterday, but it was fine. They did fly a kite. So our neighbor is the pastor of the Methodist Church, and they had some event where they had kids pick up these fun creativity packages that included kites. And afterward, she had extras, so she brought them by because she knows we have five kids, and she sees them outside all the time. And so
it was very, very nice.
Very nice of her. She to bring them by. It's nice that she remembers us. She recognizes, you know, the kids. And so she brought them by. And then Ben and Lucy and Anthony all flew kites today, which was nice. It was just enough wind, I think.
It was perfect.
Yeah. So that was really nice. So that was today. And then last week I mentioned that I had my merit badge class. I was talking about how I was worried about that and how was it going to go. And I really didn't want to do it. It was all right.
Not great.
It wasn't great. It's hard. It's hard to relate to kids you don't know. So I've never met any of these kids before. Through this Zoom conference, half of them have their cameras on and half don't. I can't make them have their camera on. It's not a requirement. I can't require it. And I'm talking about, and I'm doing a thing I've never done before, which is be a merit badge counselor. So I'm trying to talk through things. Some of them are participating. Others are kind of just hanging back. I've had like one kid who's been trying to complete the requirements so far, like finish the assignments that I give out. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to go. We'll see. I've got three more sessions, so we'll see how it goes. It'll be lessons learned. We'll go from there. You know,
when you're trying to teach new content, a new class, it's always rocky at first.
Right.
You learn a lot of lessons on the fly, and then you learn a lot of what not to do. But
that's what I'm doing. So,
yeah, I've been there. Oh, my first year of teaching at Salem State was bad. It was rocky.
Yeah.
Let's just say that.
Well, and especially if the kids don't participate much. There's a few that did. the couple of kids really were, you know, they had some questions and we had some back and forth.
Right.
But even just the technology is difficult because you get 15 kids and their audio isn't great because they're, by and large, they're using the mics that are built into their computers in front right. of them. Their connection may not be great. There's noise in the background, other people doing things around them. And, you know, hearing them, the delay, it just is not a great, it's not a great situation, but it's what we got.
So basically you're in the position of all of the school teachers of America who have been trying to figure out this technology.
Well, worse, because at least those school teachers know their kids in their class.
Right.
I don't know any of these kids. They are all strangers to me. So I'm even one step further removed from them. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I was watching today. This is actually, we didn't put this in the rundown, but there was this, my nephew is a graduating senior from Providence College, who is also in ROTC, who's about to be commissioned a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army. And they had an award ceremony. They give out awards for all the best cadets in the battalion at the Patriot Battalion at Providence College. And so I watched, my brother at the last minute said, "Hey, this is live streaming on YouTube. Check it out." So I got in there and he won three awards. Two at the beginning and one at the end, but very prestigious awards. And he was like the commander of his battalion, the cadet commander. So he was very accomplished. But just watching them try to do it via Zoom, this award ceremony, you know.
I thought it was interesting. Only a couple of the cadets were actually in uniform. A lot of them were just...
Some had a jacket and tie.
Yeah.
My nephew was just in an open collared shirt.
He looked very casual.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether the memo got out that they were supposed to dress up or not. Probably not. If they were supposed to dress up, John Paul would have dressed up.
I'm guessing that some of them just sort of took it upon themselves to do so and kind of made everybody else look bad.
Right. But some of the presenters were on via Zoom and and now presenting is this guy from such and such place. Sir, you're muted. Unmute your microphone.
Yeah.
Could you start again? We didn't get the name. I mean, just it's very awkward. So the whole thing is awkward. But anyway, good weekend. Good week coming up. Hopefully a couple of days might have a little bit of rain as far as weather goes. So the question is do we? Oh, and we didn't mention the kids slept out in the tent last night.
They did.
Which was
four out of the five.
Four out of five. Sophie chose not to. She has a hard time sleeping in the tent. When we go camping, the first night she has a difficult time getting a good night's sleep.
She has insomnia the first night.
Yeah.
Every time we go camping. And finally, at least now we've had enough experience that we're like, I can just say, you always have insomnia the first night. And then after this, you'll be fine. Right. And she can kind of say, okay, it's only tonight. I know I'm going to get a better night's sleep tomorrow night. And so she doesn't get quite so anxious about it.
She gets anxious because she thinks that all of the time that we're going to be camping somewhere, especially if we're camping for a week, she's not going to be able to sleep the entire time. But right. Of course, she after the first night, she gets into it. So, but since it was for one night, she wasn't going to like go through that. So she slept in her bed. But the others all made it the whole night in the tent. And it worked out. And then Anthony, since we're recording this, we're releasing this days after it occurs. So I'm not giving him, no one will know this until that. But Anthony's decided to, the rest have decided to sleep inside tonight, but Anthony's decided to stay out there by himself in the hammock. He wants to sleep in the hammock tonight outside. I said to Melody before we started recording, I say 60-40 he stays out there all night. 60% chance he stays all night.
I think he'll do it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a part of me that it'll get too cold or there'll be bugs or whatever.
It's pretty early in the year for bugs, and it's supposed to be pretty warm tonight.
Yeah.
So I think he's got a good chance of making it.
It's good. It's good. So we'll see. Yeah. The only question is how long we leave the tent up for.
Yeah, I give it one more day. If nobody wants to sleep outside tomorrow night, then I think it comes down.
It is a big tent. It is a lot of work to build it up and take it down. So I'm game. I was happy to do it without complaining to put it up because I told them we were going to do a backyard camp out, but yeah, we can't kill the grass. So
you can't leave it up forever.
Yeah. We'll put it back up again in a few weeks and we'll do it again.
Yeah. It was good. It was an all around great day. And I spent most of the day going back and forth inside and out. I made granola and...
you did a lot of cooking.
A lot of cooking.
Yeah, which we can get into now. Actually, we can talk about what, we've been cooking and eating this week. I did want to mention one thing. Most of the stuff is stuff we made this weekend. But one thing we made last week was the first... I was able to make sausages on the grill for the first time this year. And we've been making them in the oven. And there's a huge difference in quality between the sausages cooked on the grill, Italian sausage, and the sausages made in the oven. It just, it's so much, like, it's orders of magnitude better, right?
I am not a huge Italian sausage fan to begin with, so
okay.
It's not my favorite meal.
Okay. I find that when they're cooked in the grill, they get the smokes, the smokiness, the grill flavor, and they're not as fatty because it burns off in the grill as opposed to kind of sitting in it. You know, so they get all kind of wrinkly in the oven.
I guess.
I think it's because it's a drier cook than a wetter cook. An oven is moister than the grill. I don't know what it is.
I'll be honest. Half the time when we have Italian sausages for dinner, I just eat the vegetables and I don't actually have a sausage, or I have like half a sausage. I'm just not really a big Italian sausage fan. I cook them because everybody else likes them.
And it's an easy meal to...
And it's a very, very easy meal. I mean, if you grill them, I have no work to do on that end.
That's true.
And if I'm putting it in the oven, it's just like throw them on a sheet pan and put them in the oven.
Right.
That's the only reason I really like it, is because it's a no frills, easy to throw together meal.
All right, so let me switch gears on that then and talk about your pasta sauce, because we had pasta in sauce with the sauce you made from scratch. We've talked about your sauce from scratch, but I have to say, bring it up, that after you made that sauce the other night, the whole house smelled like my Auntie Jenny's house when I was a kid.
That's really, that is, you know, an amazing compliment, because I am not Italian.
Nope.
And your Auntie Jenny is Sicilian.
Full on, and like amazing cook. She was an amazing, like all my aunts, amazing cooks. So.
I mean, that's a big standard to live up to. I was a little bit afraid. I have to say, I approached making like pasta sauce with trepidation, because after all, you grew up having like authentic.
And making it. Well, and in fact, when we were first married, I continued to make the sauce because that was working from home. It was just the two of us and Bella. So we shared a lot more of the cooking than now. But even then, like, I think I'd made the sauce more often, but it kind of like the bread baking, it kind of got handed off to you after a while, and you kind of ran with it. And took the principles and kind of...
Right. I mean, I grew up making pasta sauce. Like, that was one of the first things that I cooked when my mom was teaching me how to cook. I'll confess that I started off with, like, I would chop up an onion and then add a jar of pasta sauce.
Everybody did that. Even right. I did that.
And then, like, add some meat and stuff. So it was sort of a hybrid, like, I would add spices.
Yeah.
Like, and add some more herbs and stuff. And it was really good.
Yeah.
For what it was.
I used to do that in high school with my buddy Rick. We would make dinner. You know, we'd hang out at his house or my house and we'd make dinner for ourselves. And that's how we would do it. But one of the things, like, this is a compliment, really. Your sauces were weird at first. Like, you would throw all kinds of stuff in it, like vegetable stuff. And that was okay. But really, like, all that extra stuff wasn't all that necessary. Like, the sauce should be sauce. But, like, now the sauce is, like, even with the extra stuff that you sometimes do put in, it's actually still really good, like, because when you do the, when you add the tomato paste and you brown the tomato paste first, and it really gives it that deep flavor, and the olive brine, what you do sometimes, I don't think you do that a lot.
I don't do that as much.
What are the big things that you do now that you really feel like are the key?
So I think the key is I start off with, heating the oil in the pan, and I throw in some anise and fennel and red pepper flakes.
And that's where you get the smells like Auntie Jenny's house.
Right. It took me a long time to figure out the anise fennel combination.
Yes.
Which I use the whole spices and I just throw them in the oil.
Whole. Yeah.
And just let them simmer for a bit. And then I throw in the onions, let those get soft. And then I throw in the garlic. You don't want to put the garlic in at the same time as the onions or the garlic will burn.
Right.
Then I usually throw in the tomato paste and let it cook in the oil and kind of get a little bit
caramelized.
Mm-hmm. And then I throw in my, you know, tomatoes, crushed tomatoes and some red wine, some oregano and basil. But I really think the anise and fennel,
yes,
with the basil is really the key flavor. Sometimes I add olives and brine for a more sort of puttanesca kind of vibe.
Frankly, you and I like that better than the kids do.
The kids don't really love it.
Yeah.
I kind of like the briny spiciness.
I think the anise and fennel, though, is really like Southern Italian. Like, I mean, red sauce is Southern Italian to begin with, but I think like Sicilian. I'm not sure if that's really Neapolitan. I think it, because I don't know. That's a good question.
It's a good question, but that was the kind of, that was the pizza sauce I grew up with. My favorite pizza joint had the anise and the fennel.
Yeah.
And it took me forever to figure out that's what I was.
And that's that smell.
That smell. Oh, it's so good.
So, yeah, try it. And that's the thing is, the key is in the oil, let it like sort of simmer in the oil, the whole spices, because the flavor compounds are oil soluble. So they come out in the oil. So that's really good. Don't burn them. No, don't do it over high heat.
Yeah, you want medium
heat. Medium heat. So, what else? So this weekend, you had picked up a rack of baby back? No, just pork ribs.
Yeah, I don't think they were baby back. No.
I think they were St. Louis style. Anyway,
probably
barbecue ribs. And we talked about last August. We talked about on the podcast about making ribs. But I want to reiterate how simple it is and how good it comes out. I don't have a smoker, so it's just a regular Weber kettle grill. But the recipe from Cook's Country is so good because, you know, you put a few spices on the ribs. You wrap it up, you put it in the fridge overnight, you know, they say from 1 to 48 hours overnight. And I put it on the grill around noon, and then it takes about 4 or 5 hours to cook. And so it's on the grill, coals on one side with a foil packet of chips, you know, wood chips for smoke on the top of the coals. And you put the ribs on the other side of the grill and you just let it, you know, cook slowly for a couple hours. Then you take it out and you put it in the oven, wrapped in foil tightly with barbecue sauce on it. So I use homemade barbecue sauce this time for another couple hours. And frankly, the longer you can do that, the better, because you get that crust, the bark. Right. Oh, so good. And the kids love it. We only had the one rack. I wish we had
we didn't really have the room in the freezer for two racks.
Yeah. But I think we really ran out of, it really wasn't enough rib. So
no, there wasn't enough.
So, but and it takes 2 days basically to make it. You have to make sure you have a good day of where you can grill. But it was so good. It was really good, those ribs, and it just smells so good.
Yeah, we had a little bit of difficulty with the timing on the ribs because I was also making
bread.
Bread.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't want my bread to over-rise.
Right. So the ribs had to come out so the bread could go in. And of course, the ribs are cooking at a lower temperature, you know, at 250. That's not hot enough. So,
right.
Yeah, the ribs had to come out a little earlier than we wanted, but it's okay. I mean, it was fine.
And the bread went in a little bit later than I wanted, and it was kind of a weird compromise.
Yeah. So, but the other thing you made yesterday was you made a shrub. We've talked about shrubs before, but as a recap, a shrub is a drink that's basically fruit and vinegar as a concentrate. To which you add either club soda or sparkling wine or...
Yeah.
And sugar.
And sugar. So, yeah, it's... I've seen two different... Basically, there's two different theories of shrub. It's a... One uses a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio of fruit to sugar to vinegar. And one used a 2-to-1-to-1, 2 fruit to 1...
Vinegar.
Vinegar one to sugar. 1 sugar.
Yeah.
So it's really simple. You basically... cook the sugar and the
fruit.
No. Cook the sugar in the water until it makes a simple syrup and sugar is totally dissolved. Then you throw in your fruit and you simmer it until the fruit has basically leached all of its juice out and it looks like shriveled and colorless.
Okay.
And limp.
Appetizing.
Then you strain it out and you add in your vinegar and... Then you're done. You refrigerate it. There's also a slow method, which I'm actually working on one of those, where you, instead of cooking it, you just macerate the fruit in the sugar
In the fridge.
On the counter, actually.
On the counter,
Or in the fridge. You can, depending on, like, the climate, for a couple days, and then you add, then you strain it and add the vinegar.
Hmm.
So I did both. So the cooked one, I cooked, I had some raspberries in the freezer, and I split them into two batches, and one I'm macerating with the sugar on the counter. The other I cooked with some blood oranges. The blood oranges I bought at the grocery store were a little on the sour side, and nobody really wanted to eat them. But they have a really beautiful flavor and a gorgeous color. And I thought blood orange and raspberry would be really good. So I cooked those up with some mint sprigs from the garden. And I had some champagne vinegar that I got on sale at the grocery store. Sounds really fancy, but I got it for a good price. And that made a really, really nice shrub. I'm drinking it with club soda, although I had one with a shot of rum in it, which was also good.
I have to admit, like, the vinegar thing is just, it's not really me.
Uh-huh.
But it's tasty. It is tasty. The blood orange raspberry mint thing is good. So it was good.
Yeah.
So the other thing you made was you made almond flour brownies, which were Lucy friendly. So,
yep. Very, very moist and fudgy brownies with the almond flour.
And because the kids wanted to roast marshmallows and we didn't have chocolate bars, Hershey's chocolate bars to make s'mores, you came up with an interesting compromise.
So we just roasted marshmallows and stuck them on top of the brownies, and they had brownie s'mores?
Sabownies? Sabrownies?
I don't know what you call them. they were good. The kids liked them.
Yeah, that was interesting. I didn't have one of those.
I just had the brownies.
Yeah. I mean, because if we're doing a camp-in, they're going to roast marshmallows over the fire, right?
Well, so, you gotta roast marshmallows.
Yes. So that was good. You also, I mean, you were all over the place with this, with the cooking. So you also had heard, we have in our garden, like in our decorative garden, hostas, which are perennials, right? Is that what they, annuals or perennials?
Perennials. Perennials. That means they bloom.
They come up
again. They come up every year.
Yes.
Yeah. They're like a bulb underground.
Yeah. So, and they grow gigantic. And you had read that hostas were edible.
Evidently, they're a delicacy in Japan. I had to try this. I read about it. I was like, I've got to try. So you cut the shoots before the leaves start to unfurl, preferably when they're tightly furled, and then you saute them. I just did a little bit of butter and olive oil with some scallions from the garden. They were pretty tasty. They kind of tasted a little bit vaguely like asparagus, kind of a fresh green sort of flavor.
There was a bit of an asparagus flavor in it. There was also a bit of a savoriness in it that I was trying to figure out what it was. Almost like, not, I said almost like clam, but not fishy or seafoody. There's a savoriness in clam that was similar.
I don't see the clam.
I know
thing at
it's hard to pin down, but it's something. It's not a prominent flavor in clams, but it's there. There's something in my head said clam, but
that's weird.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, that's. Yeah.
And then I also made a batch of granola too on Saturday.
And granola, you were all over the cooking.
So, I was,
yeah.
But I was going outside frequently. Like, I was taking pictures of all of everybody's doing the gardening and the tent set up and Bella's knot tying, and that actually kept me kind of popping in and out.
Yes,
all day long.
And then this morning, Bella was she totally wanted to do some camp cooking. She wanted to make sure that she got some camp cooking in this weekend. And there wasn't really anything that we could do for dinner last week. We didn't really plan ahead for it.
Yeah, we hadn't bought groceries for camp cooking. So it was a sort of spontaneous camp out.
Right. So what we decided was, is our traditional camping breakfast is bacon and bacon toast. I set up my Coleman stove in the camp kitchen, and I showed her how to set it up, how to light it. We put the griddle on, and she got out the bacon and put it in the pan, and she did the flipping and taking it off, and she did the whole thing, and then we got some bread. She got a bagel for herself and did the whole.
I didn't get any bacon toast. I feel cheated here.
I don't know where you were. You were inside sitting in your chair on the computer, I think.
I was inside.
When the children were bringing you bacon.
They were bringing me bacon. I did not miss out on the bacon, but I missed out on the bacon toast, which I probably would have had a piece.
Yeah. Well,
I'd realized that was going on.
You lost.
I guess. So.
One of these times, though, I'm going to do it. I'm going to make bacon toast with avocado smashed on it.
Bacon avocado toast. That sounds decadent.
It does sound awesome. So I had a piece of your bread that you made. Bella did a bagel, which frankly is amazing to a bagel with the bacon fat. Anthony just had regular like sliced bread. I think Sophie did too. And yeah, it was as good as you'd imagine. So good. But I'm proud of Bella. She really wanted to do it. She did it. That was good.
Yeah.
So we'll do some more of this. I think we need to plan some camp cooking. I want to do some Dutch oven cooking.
Well, for her cooking merit badge, she actually needs to do a meal planning and cooking for an outside thing. So
we're going to do that. We'll get the Dutch oven out and we'll do some Dutch oven cooking and we'll do the whole shebang. It'll be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to doing this. I'm glad I got the fire pit out again, too. It's a metal fire bowl. It's a fire bowl, really.
Bowl, yeah.
Yeah, which I'm a little worried because it's been out in the weather for a couple of years, and so it's a little rusty, and I'm not sure it's going to collapse. So I think I need to build a fire pit.
That'd be good. Where would we put it?
I think we put it right where it is.
It's kind of in the middle, though.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to think about it.
Because right. when the kids are doing sprints across the yard, they frequently right. sprint right through there.
We could put it on the side behind where the grill is.
Maybe. Yeah,
we'll see.
Anyway.
We'll talk about it.
Yeah.
We won't take up everybody's time deciding this. All right. So that's what we've been eating. And I'm sure we'll have some good stuff coming up, too. And so let's talk about what we've been reading or watching. I didn't get your list, by the way, before we started. So this is all my stuff. But if you've got something.
I have something, actually.
Excellent.
Yes. So Isabella has been taking an online class through Homeschool Connections, a literature class this time. And she was reading Enemy Brothers, which is a historical novel, a World War II era historical novel. And she was really excited about it and telling me all about it and all about her classes. And I thought, that sounds interesting. I'll read it. I needed something really light to read. And so I did. I picked up Enemy Brothers and I really, really enjoyed it.
So what's it about?
So the premise is there's a very large English family. I think I actually could not keep track of all of the kids. There's probably like a dozen of them. Their father had one set of kids. His wife died. He remarried. He had another set of kids. So it's a very big family. And sometime in the past, like 10 years ago, the toddler was kidnapped by an acquaintance of the mom. She is a woman who she'd gone to school with when she was in Germany, I think. So it was a German woman who kidnapped this boy. So he's been raised in Germany thinking that he's German. He thinks his name is Max Eckermann, but he's really their little brother, Tony. And so most of the mother and father both tragically died shortly after he was kidnapped. And so they spent some time looking for him, but then because of the death and the illness and everything, they just didn't have the resources to keep looking for him. And so most of the family sort of moved on, the brothers and sisters, you know, the older ones are trying to take care of the younger ones after their parents' death. But there's one brother who just doesn't give up. He promised his mom her dying wish, you know, mom, I promise I will not stop looking for Anthony. And then, so ironically, the book opens, they've found him. Another brother was
named Dim.
Yeah, no, the brother who has kept looking is Dim, but there's another brother, Ginger, who's a sailor, I think, or airman. Anyway, they capture this boatload of Norwegian boys
in World War II,
and one German boy who have escaped, and this German boy is just he's a horrible brat. He was rad, like the Norwegians when they were escaping, like they took him with them because he was just such a brat. They were afraid he was going to rat them out. And so like they're like, what do we do with this German kid, this 10-year-old, 12-year-old German boy. We don't know what to do with him. And then Ginger brings him to Dem and says, you know, can you watch him? Nobody knows what to do with him. And he recognizes him right away. Oh, my goodness. It's Tony.
But he was kidnapped as a baby.
Right. But they had been sent. The German mom who had, woman who had kidnapped him had felt bad at some point and sent them a photograph. Just sort of like, he's alive.
Okay.
And so he recognized him from the photograph. He also, she had also sent a crayon drawing that he'd made of his house. And so the first proof that they do is like, can you just, you know, draw your house for me? Here's a really nice set of colored pencils. And he's bored. He's ornery. He's lonely. He draws a house and it matches, not perfectly, but really close.
Okay. So they've brought him back to England.
So he's
to,
in England.
To their home.
So yeah, they end up saying, well, we don't know what to do with him. We'll volunteer to take care of him while you investigate whether he really is our brother Tony or he is really is this German boy who just happens to kind of look
this,
like our
this
brother.
This Nazi
Tony.
German boy, right?
Nazi, right? He is a member of the Hitler Youth, and he is very, very, very convinced of the goodness and rightness and justice of the Nazi cause. He is not at all sympathetic as the story opens. But his brother believes in him, and he's like, he's very, like, the brother Dem is just this wonderful character. He's so sympathetic, and I believe that you are Tony, and I understand you love your German mother. You don't know that you are anything but German. I think I can win you over. I think that our family will win you over. But I know it's going to take time. So he strikes a deal with him. You can run away 9 times. I'm going to give you 9 lives like a cat.
Okay.
And we will pick you back. You know, we'll bring you back 9 times and no repercussions. After the 10th time, that's it. We're going to have a big row, which I love that that English word row.
Uh-huh.
And so it takes a long time.
Okay.
Eventually, they do realize that he is the long-lost brother, and he comes to realize that he's the long-lost brother. It's a beautiful...
Spoilers.
Shh.
Obviously.
Right. I mean, it's obvious. It's of course, you know it's going to happen. But what I really loved is the story of the redemption, that he undergoes a change of heart. He comes to know himself, and he comes to love them, and he is given so many chances. The 9 lives thing is just a really beautiful... metaphor in the story for the way that love is forgiving. It's accepting. It accepts him for where he is. And all the other family siblings all insist on calling him Tony. You are our brother, Tony. We're not going to give up on you. But Dem has this beautiful grace where he gives in. He calls him Max. You think that you're Max. Your mom called you Max. You grew up thinking of yourself as Max. I will call you Max until you decide that you want to be called Tony.
Which, you know, given that all you know is your name is Max, and that would be disconcerting to lose your name. So right. that is a good understanding.
But yeah, it was a beautiful story about the war, and you get really into a lot of this stuff about the rationing and the air raids and the bombs and the sort of the typical what it's like to be in Britain during the war. But then you also get this really nice sense of what it's like to be a German in the war. And he's unsympathetic at first, but over time you really start to feel sympathy for poor Max Tony and his loyalty to his German homeland, as he thinks of it.
Okay.
So I really liked it.
And Bella really likes it.
Yes.
Yeah, she's talked to me several times, so she's trying to convince Sophie to read it. Who she will eventually read it when Bella stops bugging her to read it,
of course,
because that's Sophie.
I'm kind of tempted to buy the audiobook for Ben because I think he'd really enjoy it.
Oh yeah, that'd be good. All right, so I finished a book since we've talked before. So I read the Rise of Skywalker novelization, the last Star Wars movie that we just had. Bella actually read it before I did, which was funny, but it's pretty much the movie. Except they add a few things in that kind of explain parts of the movie that were things that were kind of loose threads in the movie. One of the things, like, where did Palpatine come from?
Right. That's just like he's like, totally out of
how
the
is
blue.
He not dead? They, you know, Darth Vader threw him down the Death Star shaft. Boom, he's dead. How is he now alive all these 30 some odd years later? And they explain it that he had created clone bodies and had Attack of the Clones or Revenge of the Sith, he told Anakin that the Sith have powers that some deem unnatural to keep their life going. And apparently that power is related to, like, when Yoda becomes in Obi-Wan become Force ghosts, it's related to that, where at the moment of death they project their spirit, however they think they conceive of it, into another body, a clone body. But the clone body, it was unexpected, so the clone body wasn't quite ready, and so the clone body is dying, and they're trying to get it right, and they keep cloning, and the clones just aren't perfect, and which is brings us to why he wants to do what he wants to do in Rise of Skywalker. I'm trying to remember the name. So there was that. There was a couple other bits and pieces. There was a little bit about how Lando, it turns out Lando Calrissian's daughter was one of the children kidnapped by the First Order to turn into stormtroopers, and so he was seeking his daughter for a long time. And so at the end of Rise of Skywalker, when he sees the Janna and the other ex-stormtroopers who defected, he's some people interpreted his interest in her as like creepy old man, mm-hmm. but it was him saying, "Hey, I can do some good. I may not be able to find my daughter, but maybe I can reunite some kids with their parents."
Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
Yes.
How hard would it have been to include something that explained that in the movie?
I don't know. They're always cutting things for runtime and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I mean, maybe in an extended edition of the movie, they'll include
sometimes,
some of the stuff.
Sometimes when you see what they cut and then what they leave, I just think,
right?
Why?
And there was some of the internal monologue for Kylo Ren and Rey that kind of explains some of it, some of the motivations and what's going on. Like, so you see the action, but to hear their internal monologue, oh, that's why that was going on. So yeah, it was helpful. It was, and it wasn't a lot, but there was a few bits that made it worthwhile to read it for me. So that was good. Not a must have, but for a fan, it'd be worth reading. So that I read that. So, and then what I've been watching, I watched a few things on Netflix, a couple movies. One is called Code 8, and it stars the Amell brothers, Robbie Amell and Stephen Amell. Stephen Amell played Green Arrow in the DC, the TV show, the Green Arrow TV show, the DC Comics TV show. And Robbie Amell has been in a couple of DC Comics things. So they're brothers. So Robbie was a star. It imagines a world in which people began exhibiting superpowers more than 100 years ago, around the time of the Industrial Revolution, around or before the time of the Industrial Revolution. So it's an alternate history sort of thing.
Okay.
And the interesting aspect of it is that they became the Industrial Revolution. They were the engines of industry, literally, themselves, until they began to be replaced by mechanical devices. And so they became second-class citizens. And so, in fact, people with superpowers are deemed to be sort of second-class, and they need to be controlled because, of course, they have these powers that are dangerous. And so they're restricted under law, and they have a hard time getting jobs. And it was an interesting inversion of the superhero trope, which we've been seeing a lot of inversions of the superhero idea in media in the past few years. Amazon's got The Boys, which was a really very explicit and very violent version of that. But so this was another one of those. And so he has these superpowers, and he has to work under the table. They work illegally. You know, there's all these kind of interesting things. They're not supposed to use their powers, but sometimes they're paid to do so. He becomes a criminal because he has to raise all this money to get treatment for his mother, who has cancer, but she also has superpower that's causing a problem with the cancer treatment. So she needs a special treatment, so on and so forth. Anyway, interesting. There were a couple of allusions to both immigration and the minority problem. Sometimes a little too on the nose with that. The drug war and all sorts of stuff. Like that. It was all right. It was worth watching. It wasn't great. It was okay. It was worthwhile. The other one I watched on Netflix was Extraction, starring Chris Hemsworth, Thor.
Okay.
So he is a mercenary who is often, he's hired to rescue people, kidnapped people. And so he's hired by this drug lord in India, I think, to rescue his teenage son who's been kidnapped by a rival drug lord in Bangladesh.
Okay.
So bad people, where, you know, and he's another trope. He is suicidal, doesn't have much to live for because his young son died and broke up his marriage, and now he has nothing to live for, sort of thing. And so the action in this movie is incredible. I mean, they really go out. There's one long action sequence in the middle of the movie that is shot as one take. It's not one take. They're obvious to some, if you're looking for it, you can see where the cuts are. But it's one camera take. Like, they jump in a car, and the camera sweeps into the car with them, and then they crash, and the camera sweeps out of the car and follows them into a building, and like all these things. It's kind of amazing, just even knowing that it's not one take, just how they put it all together. It's pretty wild. And so the action is pretty heavy duty. But the story is pretty good too. And there's a nice, like, father son metaphor going on. There's a relationship in there, mm-hmm. which is pretty good. So, it was a pretty good movie. And also, David Harbour from Stranger Things was in it. So that I always enjoy seeing David Harbour. Coffee and contemplation flow. Mornings are for coffee and contemplation. I love that line. So David Harbour was in it. It was good. And Chris Hemsworth is good. He wasn't, you know, jokey fun Thor.
Right.
But he was worth watching. It was good. So those are what I watch on Netflix. But the one thing I really want to recommend is The Chosen. I know everybody's talking about it, and people are telling me, and this is what happens. You got to watch this new Christian thing. It's awesome. Oh, it'll change your life. And I'm always like, oh, it's just going to be bad. Like, I'm sorry. But so often these like Christian movies are just like, or TV shows or whatever. They're like, they mean well, but they're not written well, or they're not filmed well, or you're supposed to make allowances because it's Christian. You know what I mean? And, mm-hmm. and so I was reluctant for a long time, but finally enough people had said, look, you just give it a chance. Just watch one. You'll understand why. So the way you watch it is actually kind of interesting. It's not like on Netflix or something. You download the app from, you know, on your iPad or on your phone. And then you can watch for free, but they encourage you to pay it forward, which means, you know, you can watch the episodes for free because other people have paid for you. But if you buy the season for like $15 and it's 8 episodes or something like that, you're paying it forward so other people can then watch, but then you get access to the whole season too. And what that does is it's raising money so they can film the next season. So they plan to have 7 seasons following the life of Christ. All right. So the premise is it starts with Mary Magdalene, and you don't really see Jesus at all until the end of the first episode. So really the major characters are Mary Magdalene, Nicodemus, and Simon Peter.
Okay.
In the beginning. And they're very, it feels like a TV show. Like, I'm trying to compare it to like something that's other, just like a show that you'd find on USA or AMC or like that sort of level of movie making, TV making. It's not Game of Thrones. It's not HBO. It's not, you know, Showtime major. It's sort of a little step back from that. The historical accuracy, like the Roman costumes, like I told you, the one thing that kind of got me was Peter's putting on his sandals and they have buckles.
Oh no.
Like,
that's just wrong.
They didn't have buckles. Sorry. They tied them on. The sandals didn't have buckles.
Buckles are a much later invention.
But theologically, on the money. Theologically, and there's plenty of this to kind of go, but there's something about the character of Jesus and the actor who plays him and the encounters he has with people that every time, I know I'm Sicilian. I'm sort of an emotional sort of guy.
Uh-huh.
I want to cry every time. Like, every time he heals someone, every time he forgives someone, he has these encounters with people, and it's incredible. Like, this is, it's hard for me to put into words what's going on in this that is so compelling, but it is. And this, like, one of the episodes is the wedding at Cana with Mary, and it's, she's not regular, ultra pious Mary in blue, you know, that sort of thing. She's Jesus's mom. She's loving. She's generous. She's happy. She's Jesus's mom. Of course, she's a wonderful person, right? But she's also just a regular woman of Judea, you know, woman from Nazareth. And there's that element there. And she, but it's just so good. And to see, like, Jesus with his mother. He's a regular guy. He's very, everyone keeps saying, what they love about this Jesus is he's relatable. And I see what they're saying. He's holy. He's saintly, of, you know, to, if you want to call God saintly. You know,
right.
But, you know, like, he's like a really awesome person, but he's a guy. And he has there's something about it. He knows more about everyone and everything than everyone else does. There's just something about him, you know, that, and it just draws you to him. I really love that character. I also really love the Nicodemus character, because he's a Pharisee. In the Bible, Nicodemus was the Pharisee who loved Jesus, along with Joseph of Arimathea. But he's coming to understand him. He's fascinated by him. Nicodemus is highly respected, but he is compelled to follow Jesus and find out what's going on. And because he had met Mary Magdalene before when she was possessed by demons, and then through her healing by Jesus, he's drawn to Jesus. Anyway, The Chosen. I've watched five or six episodes of the first season, which is eight episodes, and it's really, really good. I can't wait to watch the last few of them. This is one of those ones. Usually, I give the disclaimer. I've only watched so many, so if something really horrible happens in the next two, don't blame me. I'm pretty sure nothing really horrible happens.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah. One of the characters, Matthew the tax collector, I got just one more thing about him. It's very interesting. So he's a tax collector. Everyone hates him. In this, they play him as on the Asperger's, on the spectrum. I mean, however you want to call it. Socially inept, so does not have the social graces, does not take social cues from anyone. He's a little bit germophobic, sort of OCD almost, where he wipes things down before he picks them up. You know, he won't take things from someone. He only takes it in a cloth in his hand, that sort of thing. He's, you know, very germophobic. But he's also he doesn't get things, and he's kind of blunt about things. So he's that very socially awkward, doesn't understand social cues sort of person. And it's very interesting to see him as the Apostle Matthew in this initial stages of, he's not yet at the point where Jesus calls him to be an apostle, but he's fascinated. He's befuddled. He doesn't understand what he's seeing. He saw the miracle of the multiplication of loaves and fishes. He saw Jesus, not loaves and fishes, the catch of fish that Simon, you know, throw your net down the other side and he pulls up enough fish to almost capsize the boat. Fascinating. There's aspects of this that is this really, really like. It's kind of hard to explain it, but
I have to say, I've had a lot of friends who just, this would not be their, it would, I was surprised that they recommended it. I will probably watch it at some point, especially given your rave reviews. Mm-hmm. I'm just not really in the mood right now. I don't know why.
See, this is the thing. I was initially resistant, but come to the light side
the light side.
Yes, resistance is futile
someday. Yeah, not today.
Yeah, it's the app is on the iPad and you can always watch it whenever, you know. So really good. There's something about it. It'll be hard to watch when they get to the crucifixion because you're going to spend seven seasons getting to know this guy that is really relatable and you really like, and I think that's by design. I think it's kind of interesting. He also has a great sense of humor, by the way.
I think it's interesting. I don't know, that has there ever been a miniseries like at this length about Jesus?
No, they've never had a multi-season series about Jesus.
I mean, because that's really, I'm kind of fascinated by the idea of the development over time, like that, yes. that immersion in the world before you get to the crucifixion, because I think that movies, like, they don't really give you enough time to really get to know the character of
Jesus. And time is necessarily compressed.
Right.
Yeah.
It's compressed. And I think that, we've said this before about other works, that the miniseries allows more time for the development of characters. That it's much more novel, like a novel, than...
And this isn't a miniseries, but a series. Now, it's not a 26-episode season. It's an 8-episode season. But, you know, it gives more time. Now, part of what can go wrong is there is some moments in these episodes that I've watched so far where it's like, come on, get on with it. You know what I mean? Like, they're developed...
Too slowly?
They spend so much time developing the backstories of, like, Simon's... The reason Simon Peter needed all those fish was because he was back behind on his taxes, and like all these sort of connections that aren't really central to Jesus. And so I was a little like that. That was the, like, for me with the first episode, I'm like, get to Jesus, you know, like, and then you finally do. And they're like, oh, okay, that was worth it. Like, you know what I mean? And you get kind of that a few times in the season. And like, come on, get to Jesus. So there can be, when you have that much time, the temptation to include stuff that doesn't need to be.
Maybe it could have been cut a little bit tighter.
Could have been tighter because, frankly, there's plenty to talk about with Jesus. You know, there's lots of stuff. I mean, one of the things they don't show is they don't show the theophany when John the Baptist baptizes him. And behold, my son, you know, from the cloud, the Lamb of God. You get the reports of it from other people. And I get that they... That's a dramatic choice by the writer and director.
I think it could be come across as really cheesy.
It could.
And like, or alternately as like, pay attention to the CGI, the special effects, rather than the personal moment. I can see it would be very hard to do well so that it didn't err too far one way or the other.
Right. Like, there's one scene where he heals a leper, and the healing is sort of, you see the sores, like CGI disappear slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, I kind of guess they would just be gone. Like, Jesus doesn't need to, like, slowly make the disappear, like you're healing it with a Star Trek, like, flesh fuser or whatever you call it.
That's actually a really interesting question. Like,
does the healing instantaneous, like a change in state, or is it occur over time, an acceleration of the natural process?
Well, we won't know until we get to heaven, I guess.
I mean, the healing of the paralytic, pick up your pallet and walk.
Right. It does feel like kind of instantaneous.
Although in the show, we have this dramatic, like, stand, and you see him from, you know, you're looking at him from the point of view, like, you see his toes in his face, and you see his toes begin to wiggle slowly. You know, it's very dramatic. But that's the question. Was it just snap of the finger and you're up? Or was it, or you're healed? Or was it something else? Did Jesus go for the dramatic moment?
I mean, I can understand from like a movie making perspective that you want to build the drama,
right? But it's almost more dramatic to just have it be sudden. This guy who's full of sores, and then suddenly he's not. In the old days, in old movie making, that's what they would do because they didn't have CGI. They didn't have a way to believably show the sores going away, you know, over a period of time. And so there'd be moment to moment, click, he's healed. And maybe people would feel that wasn't dramatic enough, but I don't know. It is an interesting question.
Right. I mean, especially like, what would modern audiences have a harder time buying something that's instantaneous?
Yes. That is also an interesting question. Do we demand to see the work.
Which actually then becomes interesting, like, you know, are we all kind of a little bit Thomas? We want to see.
Mm.
We want to stick our hands, you know, metaphorically into the wounds. We want to kind of see the process as it goes on.
See, that's an interesting question. Are we less likely to believe miracles now because we are so inured to, or less we impressed by miracles now because we see, quote-unquote, miracles in TV and movies and...
It's like, true. I mean, like, the sort of alien healing or scientific, like,
science fiction or superheroes or all that stuff.
There's so many like people who are able to heal from things that we're kind of used to seeing that sort of thing.
Like Jack Bauer gets destroyed in the course of 24 hours, but keeps going.
That wasn't exactly what I was thinking, but sure.
But you see people like take punishment that doesn't seem possible, and like in the next scene they're up and going, or you see a superhero gets laid out and they're healed by the next scene. You know, it's just. Are we blasé about miraculous things? If a miraculous or supernatural event occurs in our presence, will we recognize it, or will it just be? I've seen better in the Marvel movie. Some YouTuber making videos about Jesus's miracles. I think Avengers: Age of Ultron did a better job of that. By the way, we watched that too.
We did. Oh, well, I sort of watched it. I kind of fell asleep in the middle.
Melanie is catching up on the Marvel movie. Now that we have Disney Plus, she's beginning to catch up on some of the Marvel movies.
Yep.
Thor. I've talked about that.
Seen Thor and Ragnarok.
Yeah. And now Age
of Ultron.
Age of Ultron.
I mostly saw Age of Ultron. I nodded off.
There were parts you have to be.
I nodded off during some of the like big fight scenes.
Well, for you, those are boring.
Actually, yeah, they really are. I like the character development stuff when it's just like boom, bang, crash, bam, like watch people throw each other across. Like I do kind of get bored after a while.
What was it, Batman versus Superman? No, it was one of the Superman movies that was a really bad version of that, where it was in fact Man of Steel, I think it was, where they destroyed New York, like Metropolis or New York City or whatever, and it's New York City is Metropolis in DC Comics.
Right.
They destroy, like, literally, it's like a bomb went off in the city. The city is destroyed. And it's just so gratuitous, so much violence. And you kind of just, like, it's overwhelming. It's too much. Like, I can't buy this. So I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I just, at some point, I start to tune it out.
Yeah, the Transformers is the same problem. Michael Bay has never done it.
Not a movie I'm ever likely to want to watch.
Any of them, yeah.
No, not my cup of tea.
So one last thing I want to talk about. I know it's a little long.
It's getting late.
It is getting late. But I want to talk about this topic that we've been talking about. I wrote a blog post about. I talked about it with the Catholics of Oz. What is it going to be like when we return to parish life? What is return to parish life going to be like in the new reality that we're in?
I've been writing about that too and thinking about it and asking questions about it.
So the obvious first point is what is it going to be like to go back to Mass? And some dioceses have already gone back to having people be able to attend Mass to some degree. There's usually still social distancing in place. There's a limitation on the number of people who can go. But there are real practical questions like, so when you have a limit on the number of people that can attend the Mass, how do you decide who gets to go? Some dioceses have already announced that it's just going to be when you get there and if they're already full, you're turned away at the door, which I think is a terrible idea.
I think that And I've seen other people saying that their parish is doing a online registration and then they will like assign you a particular Mass or something like that.
Which is better because then know what to expect.
Although that also feels kind of mechanical and like, I don't.
But what can you do?
I mean, it's a challenge.
And it's not like you can add an unlimited number of Masses because
priests are not robots.
They're not robots, and they're not sacrament machines. And celebrating the Mass is draining. Let me tell you, I know a lot of priests. You think it's easy to just stand up there and recite the prayers? It takes a lot out of you to do the Mass well and to preach it. So there's a huge question there, and you know things in the other sacraments, confession. But there are other longer term questions that pertain to the life of a parish, like how will we do First Communion? There are tens of thousands of kids who did not get their First Communion this spring. How are we going to handle this? Are the days of the First Communion Mass? We're not going to be doing that anytime soon, where you have, you know, 50 kids or 25 kids and all their family.
Did we talk about my friend whose child received First Communion?
You mentioned briefly. Tell me again.
Okay. So my friend Marie, her daughter was supposed to receive her First Communion last weekend. It was that was when they were going to have
scheduled.
They're scheduled, and she got a call from their pastor, who asked if they would be interested in having her come to his private live stream mass and have her receive her first communion.
So there'd be a few of the 10 people
they
allowed.
They could have the girl, and they could basically have 5 family members there.
Right.
So they have 2 kids, and so it was mom, dad, the 2 kids, and then 1 grandparent.
Okay.
It was like,
how do they fight that one out?
I think there's only 1 local grandparent.
Okay.
I could be wrong. Whew. But they asked him if he would like to come, and he said, "Well, will I get to receive communion?" And they said yes, and he was just about in tears. Excuse me. So the way they did this is because they're going to have 1 kid basically per mass, or maybe 2, depending on the size of the families. And they're going to just basically work their way through the first communicants of those who want to. They have the option of waiting until perhaps they could have a bigger ceremony with more people.
But who knows when that will be?
They can't make any promises. Now, because they're only doing 1 live stream mass per week, per weekend, but he's saying more masses, I guess, something like that. Like, they're going to have more kids than they can have on the live stream. So the pastor opted to not show the first communicant or her family on camera.
Okay.
So
that no one feels announced, bad?
Well, he announced to the congregation, to the camera, that they were having a first communion, but they weren't going to show it because it would be sort of unfair for some first communicants' families to be able to see them and some not. So sort of in the entrance.
Why not just live stream them all?
I don't know. Maybe there's a technical difficulty in live streaming them all.
No, there shouldn't be.
Or maybe they're not. Maybe it's not really like live stream, but maybe it's something else. I don't know. Anyway, yeah. This was what their parish opted to do, was the kids who want to can one by one make their first communions with, the maximum of 10 people present. Yeah. So.
And there's nothing preventing someone in one of the members of the family from live streaming on their Facebook page.
Right. So I don't think. Yeah. They opted not to. But
so that's one thing, and first confession is also another thing that has to be thought of, too, because I'm not sure I think that a 7-year-old or 8-year-old should be doing first confession 6 feet apart in the church parking lot, like some places have been doing, the drive up.
Right.
So that's going to be figured out. And what I'm saying is that none of these are insurmountable problems, but we've got to deal with it. We've got to think about these. We've got to come up with plans. We've got to what does parish life look like? Again, it could be a year or more before we get back to the ability to have a once we have a vaccine where we feel comfortable having mass gatherings, so to speak, mass gatherings mm-hmm. as in groups. And so what do we do in the meantime? All of the elements of parish life that are on hold, faith formation, how is that going to work? What are dice like? I don't say this in an accusatory sense. I say this purely as a question. What are dioceses doing to prepare, to think about this? What plans are there? I've heard from some dioceses that some bits of this, like I mentioned, the one diocese that's going to have the, if it's too full, you don't get to go. But even these other questions have not been really dealt with. I mean, there was that one diocese in Canada, the bishop, who said that we're not doing weddings because social distancing says we can have a maximum of 10 people at a mass,
right,
including the bride and the groom, and that everyone has to be social distanced at the wedding, including the bride and the groom. And I'm thinking, why? Why would the bride and the groom have to be social distanced? You do know what happens afterward, right?
It seems to me some people are kind of confused on the idea of needing to be like 6 feet apart. Like, obviously, that wouldn't apply to people in one household.
Yeah, and because you're to be one household.
Right. Like, we're requesting people not to have contact between households. Although, I think that there's also a point where, like, clusters of households could act as sort of one group that's not having contact with lots of other groups, right, and still be relatively insulated.
Right. When you take into account the kinds of exposure that group has as a whole with the outside world, does any of them work as essential workers or first responders or any of that sort of thing? These sorts of questions, how many people are they exposed to? The idea is to not expose your cluster or group to many more groups of clusters, staying relatively isolated as a group. And so if you want to have that group include your family who live in the house next door, or, you know, that sort of thing.
Right. Or even, you know, I don't see why you shouldn't have two or three neighbors' households act as a cluster or a unit.
Right.
If, as long as they're all not like, each is contacted with three others who are contacted with three others who are then you're starting to
right.
to grow a network. But if you've got three households that say none of us are going to have contact outside of this cluster of three households, then they're effectively acting as one family, one unit, even now, if they're not related.
The trick comes in when they're all individually going to, you know, different grocery stores and that sort of stuff.
Right.
But if you kind of banded together and said we're gonna shop in common or something like that.
Right. I mean, I think people could be a lot more creative, and these things are not necessarily as insurmountable.
And again, this isn't the Black Death. This isn't,
right.
This isn't the, I mean, it's a serious disease and lots of people have lost their lives and lots of people have been hurt, and we would be much worse off if we hadn't taken measures that we have. But it's also not like a floating through the air disease that we're going to catch just by being in the presence of someone who's sick. And die. You know, this is not Ebola. This is not, you know what I mean? We have to keep some measure of understanding of that. But the point back to the sacraments in the parish life is what is parish life going to be? That's the question. And that's I've yet to hear an answer to. I've heard bits of it, but nobody's really talked about what is the next year of parish life going to be like. Father Roderick actually has been talking a lot about this. He's helping parishes set up. He's like, we're going to be doing live stream mass on the long term. Like, this is, even when people can come back to mass, given the numbers that are going to be limited to, there's going to be a lot of people who are still going to be watching these streams.
Right. I mean, a lot of parishes were already doing it. Not all by any chance. There were many, let's say many.
Okay, in the aggregate.
In the aggregate, many parishes have already been either recording or live streaming mass. Even our parish was recording mass
and posting it online
For shut-ins, for people who can't make it,
sure.
to be connected. I think that what we're going to see is that that's sort of a more universal thing, that more people are expected to not be showing up to mass, and there's more concern. But I think that we need to then also pair this with
professionalization of the process.
Right, professionalization of the process, but also can we bring communion to people who are like, for right now, understandably, we're limiting to people receiving communion.
How do you even do that? The whole reason we're doing this is vulnerable populations not being exposed.
Right.
How do you possibly bring communion to people who, by definition, are probably the most vulnerable population, shut-ins, or I see what you're saying. Not just the shut-ins, but to people like us who can't get to mass because we're shut out from the limitation, but who still are relatively healthy.
Right. I mean, it seems to me that we can't treat everyone as if they're the exact same level of risk. Amy Wilburn was actually on her blog was speculating that there have been places in the church where large groups of people were regularly both going to mass and receiving communion, but not necessarily receiving communion at the mass that they attended.
Hmm.
So perhaps there's not necessarily a connection between when we receive communion and when we go to mass, which makes me think of the one time that we were at mass and we had a child who had a nosebleed during communion.
Oh, yes.
If you'll recall.
Yes, I remember.
And did not go up to communion because
they had a nosebleed.
Very bad nosebleed. And so then very kindly, the deacon after mass,
because this child was distressed and crying because they didn't get
brought us communion at the pew after mass. And I thought, you know, we assume that like everyone has to receive communion at this particular point in mass. And that's obviously the ideal. But maybe logistically speaking, there might be, I mean,
there's actually been talk. The Thomistic Institute has come out with their recommended guidelines for how to do the sacraments in this period of time. And one of their recommendations is to consider to have distribution of the Eucharist after Mass so that not everyone, so it's not people in lines processing up in these big crowds, but just after Mass, people can come as they are able with distancing to receive and receive if they feel uncomfortable with it.
Right. And maybe sort of take your time, not rush.
Right. But we have to consider what is parish life going to be like as well. Like, what is without the ministries, without the gatherings? Like, I was thinking of the prayer shawl ministry at our parish. You know, these women who get together and knit prayer shawls and blankets for people, shut-ins usually.
And a lot of them are older women who might.
And they half of it is they get together to do it. You know, these are important questions that have to be dealt with. What are we going to do for scouts, which is a whole other thing? You know, how can we do scouts when we're not together? Because most of that is about doing things together.
Right. I've seen a lot of scout families sort of talking about that. Are there going to be campouts? Can we do socially distanced campouts where we're sort of an adjacent campsites and each family is sort of camping in their own tents?
Yeah. But and you're going to keep cubs from
intermingling. Maybe with the older scouts, but.
But even then, it's a whole, and we're going along. So
yeah,
we can revisit this question, this issue. And so what I'd like to hear from you, the listener, is what's going on in your parish, in your diocese? Have you heard of anything? What do you think should happen? And again, not just the sacraments, not just mass and confession, but just parish life in general. How is this going to work? How do you think it should work where you are? Or if you've heard anything, I'd love to hear that.
Yes.
So let's wrap it up. I do want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Don H., Ryan R., Cindy M., Daniel C., and Sally H. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So you can contribute to the discussion and let us know, respond to some of what we discussed here by commenting at sqpn.com/bets, that's BETTS, or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. You can send an email to bets@sqpn.com, and any relevant links to like the books or the movies or anything we discussed, I'll put in the show notes at sqpn.com. If you have not yet done so, please subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, your favorite podcast app, or at the SQPN YouTube channel, where you should also make sure to hit the bell to get notifications. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.